service. And for tonight, that by way of a little change from our regular program, that I take up the promised story of the experiences of the work in the world. And we spent, I think, some time early in the week telling you some of these experiences. I did promise to relate some more of them before the week passed by. I mentioned that down in Australia, the work has been progressing quite remarkably. And something of this story I'd like to relate this evening, but first of all I'd like to mention a little more about the American field. I mentioned, I think, I've already been to Florida and found two good interests down there. I just received word today I have to go up to Alaska, where possibly seven or eight people will be waiting to hear the message. And then there are some very fine interests in Michigan, northern Pennsylvania, Indiana and Ohio. And of course there's the expected people in Washington DC, where I expect to have 50 people to go back and talk to them, from one man alone, plus other interests as well. And then in Birmingham, Alabama, there's a sister down there who's most anxious for me to come and spend some time with her family. She was a camp meeting in Arkansas and is rejoicing very much in this truth. And tell you the story of the Australian experiences down in more detail. When I was over in the United States last year, my wife's father, who is still a Seventh-day Adventist minister, was anxious to help a brother who is totally blind. His name is Brother Ed Stewart. And this blind brother was anxious to help his fellow blind men, and so he got himself a little printing business. He'd enlisted the help of a sister whom we'd known when we were down at college many years ago. She was a piano teacher down there. Her name is Sylvia McGowan. She'd never married, and now she had joined with Brother Stewart in this kind of self-sacrificing work to print a little magazine to assist with the blind. But They bought a second-hand printing press, and it was giving them some difficulty. And my wife's father said to Margaret, would she please come down and give them some help, because she's quite good on these little printing presses. Well, she was so busy during my absence last year, she just never got there, never had the time to go down. When I arrived back in November, it so happened that we were down in Brisbane one day together, very shortly after I'd arrived back, and just before our camp meeting. And we were round at her father's place, and he said to us, could you come just for half an hour this morning? And I said, yes, we have time. So both of us went round, went to work on the printing press, and soon had it running along quite smoothly and well. And it wasn't long before I got into conversation with Brother Stewart's. And he began to ask me something about our movement and our message, and I told him just a few details about it. And all the while, my father-in-law, Seventh-day Adventist minister, standing right by, hearing the whole conversation. So, after a few moments, I said to him, now look, Brother Stewart, today we have very little time. I have to leave in just a few moments. But beginning in about 10 days is our camp meeting up at Palmwoods. Why don't you come? I said, you can just listen. If you don't like it, you can go home again. And there'll be no compulsion whatsoever. You'll be completely free to decide just whether you want it or you don't want it. There'll be no pressure, no force whatsoever. And having said this, I turned to my father-in-law, the Seventh-day Adventist minister, and said to him, isn't that right, Dad? He said, that's right, he said, that's perfectly right. He's a very honest person, is my father-in-law, and he'd been up to our place many, many times and discussed the message very freely with me, and he's found the most complete atmosphere of freedom up there to talk or not to talk just as he wishes, and so he was able to endorse what I said. Well, we left then, went about our business, and I guess I'm a bit sceptical sometimes about people anyway. And I said to Margaret, I said, that's the last we'll hear of those people. You know what the old story is? They say they'll come, but when it comes to coming, They never turn up. So he forgot about them and filled up all the camp spaces with people. And then the Thursday evening, before the camp was to begin, we have a telephone call, and it's Brother Stewart. And he says, "Can we come up? Do you have space for us?" And Margaret, who took the call, yes, she took the call, and she's the one who more or less is hostess to all the campers, and she appoints each person where they're going to sleep and so forth. She said, "Yes," she said, "we've got space, come on up." But she had no space. But she figured she'd find some anyway. And she did some manipulation, and sure enough, we had a little space for them in a quite comfortable quarters too. Well, they came with the plan of staying only for the Sabbath and going home again on Sunday. And I think Brother Stewart was a bit sceptical about what he might hear. He'd been to hear Brinsmead, he'd been to hear the Shepherd's Rod, he'd been to hear this and that, and none of them had given him much to go by. And he felt, well, we'll make the investigation, and then we'll at least we'll say we've heard them, and that will just cross off one more possibility. But when he got there, from the very first study, he found that he was listening to something very different from what he'd ever heard before. And Sister McGowan, who came with him, likewise was much impressed by what she heard. On Sabbath afternoon, I had some time to talk with them, but not a great deal. And by the time Sunday came, they came to us and said, rather apologetically, "Do you suppose we stay the rest of the week?" Well, of course they could. And they did. And as the week went by, they came and asked me more questions, and they read the literature, and they were two people who made their minds up quite quickly about the message, and they've never looked back since. On Sunday morning, when the camp was over, we all gathered together to discuss the problem of accommodation down there, and I mention this story mostly because of the continuation of Brother Stewart's story. You see, when we built the print shop, we wisely built it much larger than the immediate needs of that moment, knowing the work would grow and grow, and eventually we'd need much more space. And rather than building a bit now and a bit more and a bit more and a bit more, we built one building large enough to take care of our needs for a long time. And so in the meantime, the church and the camp meeting used the end portion of the print shop for all our meeting places. But by the end of last year, the print shop had grown so much in the work down there that the time came we had to have all the space. And so I had to announce to the believers there they would have to decide what they wanted to do about next year's camp meeting. Should we go and rent a camp place? And down in Australia it's very, very difficult to find a place like this, almost impossible. And when they do rent them out, they want an exorbitant price for them. The alternative is a fairground, but a fairground is not very practical for this kind of purpose. And the believers down there spoke up, and they believed most emphatically that God would have us build our own building. Well, Brother Stewart had a lot to say in this. And after a moment or two of much talking, he said, "Now, just a minute," he said, "I hope you folk don't mind my speaking so much," he said, "but you have to realize we're your newest members now." So in this way he announced the fact that he really joined the movement. Well, those two folk went back home again with a real missionary spirit, and they started to turn Brisbane upside down so far as the Adventist communities were concerned. In the meantime, Margaret and I went to the New Zealand camp and down to South Australia, and we'd hardly got back when another couple came to meet with the Dixon family. Now, the Dixon family is also a very interesting story. David Dixon was one of the leading, well, not so much a, yes, he was quite a figure in the Brinsmead camp. Not a leading figure altogether, but quite a figure in the Brinsmead camp. And in our group, and he was a widower, his wife had died of cancer quite some years ago. I never ever met her. And in our group, there was a sister whose husband had died from a brain tumour, Sister Murchison. And as happens, you know, sometimes, boy meets girl, and these two folk got together. And when they did. Well, our sister progressively got this brother more and more interested in this message until finally he accepted it. And the last Sabbath of our camping down there, when the last service was over, and I was greeting the folk as they left the room, as I usually do after the ordinance service, David Dixon came out and he said to me, "Well," he said, "when I first met Helen here," that's his present wife, "the Brisbane folks said to me, 'You be careful, because she'll get you into Fred Wright's camp.'" And he said, "No worries in the world," he said, "no way in the world. But," he said, "look at me now." So they sold their home, or actually they sold her home after they'd married, and they planned to build another home for both of them on a piece of property which they'd bought jointly up the road. In the meantime, they're living in a trailer house on our property, on the movement's property. And so after camp meeting, there came another couple up from the Brinsmead camp to talk to David Dixon about some school problems. Now, prior to this, Esther, who's right here with us tonight, had met this particular sister down at a meeting conducted by McSherry. And McSherry, of course, is the leader of a certain branch of the Reformed Church, not the Nicolish group, but the group that is run by the Gutnest division from Jagsthausen in Germany. Well, this made a contact, although at that time this particular sister, whose name is Sister Bartz, did not really respond to the message, but rather seemed to be on McSherry's side. There were Brinsmead folk who had begun to have some serious misgivings about the Brinsmead's present position and began to shop around looking for something that they could change over to. So when Sister Bass turned up at our place to see David Dixon, Esther met her, and being the mystery that she is, promptly brought Sister Bass in to talk to me. I was home for once. So she came down and we began to discuss things. Just a minute, she said, "Mr. Smith will be glad to hear this." And Mr. Smith is the man who brought her up to see us. He'd driven her up because he had a car and she didn't. So he came down and at first he began to bring out all the standard Brinsmead objections. I thought to myself, yeah, well, here we have the usual Brinsmead objector and we won't get very far with this man. But after a few minutes, this brother began to, he'd say, "Well, that's new. I haven't thought about that before." And it wasn't very long before he was showing quite an interest. Well, the Dixon family, being most anxious that these folks would take the message, arranged them to stay overnight. And next morning they arranged for another study and a second study. And by the time we had those three studies, these folk were pretty well convinced that this was what they were looking for. So they go home. And next weekend they drive back again with a young man named Peter Wilson. And Peter Wilson was a boy, or a young man I suppose I should better say, about 22 or 23 years of age, who had never been a Seventh-day Adventist. He'd come right out of the world in the roughest kind of way and had joined the Brinsmead movement. But he said after a while that the Brinsmead message left him exactly as he was before when he was in the world. And it just wasn't doing for him what he looked for in religion. So when Sister Bartz found this message, she said to Peter, "I think I've found what you're wanting. Come with me to Palmwoods." So she brought him up, and he listened to a couple of studies, and he said, "Yes," he said, "this is what I'm looking for." And he took the message, and likewise he hasn't looked back either. Now to come back to Ed Stewart and Sylvia McGowan, They knew Sister Bartz and George Smith very well, and the four of them, also knew a brother in Brisbane whose name is Arthur Swift. And these four determined that whatever they did, they were going to win Arthur Swift to this message. So the four against him, he hadn't much hope, did he? Now, this is the most interesting story now, the story of Arthur Swift's conversion to this message. I first met Arthur Swift when I was back in New Zealand 12 years ago. I went to his home. We were both in the Brinsmead camp then, and we had some studies on Romans 7 and 8, but it just didn't register in his mind. His wife at that time was very, very sick with, I forgot the name of this disease now, it's that disease where the nerve endings gradually died back. What are they called again? Sclerosis of some sort. Multiple sclerosis. And after a year or two, Arthur Smith came to Australia to have Hope Taylor, Bob Brinsmead's sister, treat her. But unfortunately, she died, or maybe fortunately, I don't know which way. And the years rolled by, I never ever saw Arthur again. In the meantime, he was hearing again and again all kinds of wild stories about me personally and about this movement generally. And of course, he decided he'd give this whole thing a very, very wide clearance. But at the same time, he was a very close friend of Ed Stewart and Sylvia McGowan, and would often visit them on his way home from work. He worked on the railways at this time. Although he's a very competent typesetter, he couldn't get work in Brisbane because of the union problems. So he had to go and work on the railways, which was just a real manual job, a labourer's job. Not a very good job for a man who's a skilled tradesman. But he'd rather do that than violate his principles. And so Ed Stewart and Sylvia got him interested in the message, but they were quite tricky with him, and they wouldn't tell him very much. They'd keep his curiosity on being stirred up, because they determined that the best thing was to have him come to Palm Woods and sit down and hear the message and have his questions answered directly from me personally, especially in view of the fact that he heard all these wild stories and should come and see for himself. So finally, after a great deal of urging, he did come up to Palm Woods and was most impressed by what he saw. Went back home again, took some literature with him, and then after two or three days, there was a complete reversal of his thinking. And he wrote to me a terse little letter and said, "Fred," he said, "I'm sorry to say it, but I found that this message is error, and I won't be up to Palm Woods again ever. Yours sincerely, Arthur." Well, we felt very sad about that indeed, but somehow we just did not feel we ought to give up hope on this man. And so when the next Tuesday evening came and all the folk gathered for prayer meeting, I asked them particularly to pray for Arthur Smith, that God's Spirit might impress him yet. Now, would you believe it? At the very moment we started to pray, Daisy Bartz drove up the Joyce to Arthur Smith's place in Brisbane, and while we were praying for him up there in Palm Woods, she was down there talking to him in Brisbane simultaneously. The timing was perfect. And it worked. There's a powerful thing, you know. After they'd gone, that is, George Smith and Daisy Bartz had gone, Arthur took out his steps to Christ and sat down, and I think for 2 or 3 hours he prayerfully and thoughtfully and carefully went over and over and over that chapter on faith and acceptance, until the light suddenly broke on his mind. And he said, "Well," he said, "that's what Fred's been trying to tell me all this time. And after 12 years, I've come to see it." Some people are slow, aren't they? Well, the next morning he just couldn't get round to see Ed and Sylvia soon enough to tell them the glad news. So what's he do? He then promptly goes around to see another friend of his named Dick Johns, and it isn't very long before he's in the message. And then they went down to another family called the what's the names again?
Tom.
What name?
First name Tom. Oh no, you mean Simons.
Yeah, Simons. That's right, the Simons family down on the south coast. Now, when Ed Stewart and Sue McGowan got down there to see them, because they determined they should take the message too, they wouldn't even listen to them about this message. It so happened that around about 1955 or 56, there was some Adventist group in the southern part of Queensland at a place called Currabee, who got together in a community-style camp, and it was a real community-style camp because they practiced wife-swapping. And this became a major scandal around southern Queensland back in those days, And the Simons had heard that I was one of the instigators of this. Well, I had a very good alibi because I was over in New Zealand at the time, almost 2,000 miles away, so I had a very good alibi. And I never even knew about the thing until it was all over and done with. I've never been to Caribbee either. I've only driven past it with a signpost that says Caribbee way out here to the left somewhere, or the right, depending whether you're going north or south. And so when Ed Stewart put them straight on this, well, they said, oh, well, it makes a very different picture. Well, now listen to the message. And they listened to the message and they accepted it too. And so it was that the message just began to really spread and develop around the southern Queensland area. Now, down in North New South Wales is a brother named Frank Burke. And Frank Burke has a disease of the bones, which, and this disease apparently is robbing calcium from his bones and can't be replaced because of the nature of his disease. No one seems to be able to help him at all. And he's quite a cripple. He was a very, very good sign writer until he got too blind to see, and now he's retired. Now, over the years, and he's been in this message, I suppose, about 4 or 5 years or 6 years perhaps, I always recognized that this man had not yet found a living experience. You could tell by the way he talked, the things he said, the testimonies he gave. And I used to pray for him and labor for him and try and help him to see the message, but he always was a foolish virgin. And then about 4 months ago now, he had a tape recorder, a little cassette tape recorder, and we had sent to him a number of tapes, and amongst these was one on the cleansing of the sanctuary, much along the lines of acceptable confession. So he put it on and played it through. And when he heard it once, he said, now I must hear that one again, because there's a few points that I don't quite see properly. So he played it the second time, and the third time, and the fourth time, until he played it, you guess how many times? 12? 20? 45 times. I don't know how he kept count, but that's what he told me. And then he said, after the 45th time, he said, he got the whole point of the message, the light flooded his soul, and he said he at last found a real new birth experience. And when I met him, the transformation was just unbelievable. Whether it had been that kind of complaining, murmuring spirit, that grudge against life, that dismal note of defeat and unhappiness, now there was a wonderful depth of peace and strength there. There was a willingness to lay down and die if that time had come, whereas before there was a rebellion against that. And the transformation was just unbelievable. So different from what he'd been before. And we, of course, were so glad to see this. We just rejoiced in that transformation. Well, now, I'll tell you now a little bit about the medical mystery work that is being done down there in Australia. I've been sort of asked to do this. It's not a subject I usually speak about, as you folks recognise. Not that I don't stand for this branch of the work. I leave this to other people mostly because I have my hands really full with the work which I have to do, and I do believe in the distribution of labour. That is, as Paul says, God says some in the church as apostles, some are prophets, some are teachers, and some have the gift of healing. This work began down there, well, quite a number of years ago now. I'd like to make a few points in regard to it that I think are very, very important. So often, when people become aware of the medical mystery work as being an important branch of the third angel's message, they feel they must, first of all, go through a long course, of training, and put together a nice little clinic, hang up a sign, and open the door for business. But I believe that God doesn't begin that way. I believe God begins in the most simple possible fashion. And the first equipment that you'll have is just your bare hands. And as you learn to use what you have, then God will enlarge your knowledge and your experience little by little. And then some simple equipment may be added as time goes by. And in this way, the work will develop and grow until it becomes a very, very strong factor in your experience. Essential, of course, is that deep sense of sympathy for the early, for the sick and the suffering, a sensitivity to people's needs, and a very firm and a very deep trust in the God who can lead you and guide you in these areas. Now, Arthur Swift, as I said, is a man who was a very, very excellent typesetter. And at the same time, he is also a man who has studied massage. He's a masseur as well. And so he is bringing into the work in this respect a very, very valuable contribution. Now, I should have my wife here, of course. She could tell you stories after stories because this is her special field of labour. Perhaps I shall call her, have her come. You all look as if you might agree with that idea. But anyway, to come back to details on this particular aspect of the message, we've had some very interesting success in this work down there, although I must say that so far, even though possibly several hundred people have come through and received treatments, we've not yet found too many of them or any of them which have really taken the message. But at the same time, we do believe that a very great deal of goodwill for the message is being developed, and that the seed sown will spring up and bear a harvest by and by later on. The equipment we have now in the little medical room down there in Australia consists simply of the following. First of all, a steam tent, or in other words, a little sauna. It's a very, very simple structure. It simply amounts to a bench with a tent over the top which can be tipped back so the person can lie in there. An ordinary steam kettle, electric steam kettle, which pours in the steam and gets you really warmed up, especially in midsummer when the temperature is 103 degrees anyway. And the winter, of course, still does a very, very effective job. A shower, there's a colonic machine which is much more sophisticated than the one that Chuck was telling you about. A sitz bath for taking that kind of work, and a massage table. And that little room is kept continuously busy every day of the week but Sabbath, and most nights as well, as people come in from all directions, mostly worldly folk, and we never ever let them go without them receiving a piece of literature, if they'll take it, of course. And many a long gospel and mystery talk is given to people as they come. Now, one man who was a brother in the movement, Arthur Warren by name, came down from North Queensland suffering from a very serious lung congestion. It wasn't emphysema exactly, but it was some kind of sickness where his lungs were filling up with phlegm and congestion. Well, he felt that we were too busy there to bother us, so he decided to go to the hospital, much to our disappointment. And they worked on him there, I think, for about 10 days, and at the end of that time he was worse than when he went in. And he really thought he was going to die, quite seriously. He thought he was going to die. So the hospital discharged him as a kind of a hopeless case, and he came home again, and we invited him over to receive some treatments at our place to see if we could do him any help. So he came over, and we recognised the intimate relationship between the gospel and between health. Today the doctors of the world are like the ministers of the world. They try and cure effects without touching the causes. And for this reason, neither are successful. Neither of them. We recognise in the gospel message, of course, that we must treat the cause if we're going to take care of the effect. And we recognise that the lungs were not the place to work on basically, but this man needed a cleansing from head to toe to get right down to the deep-seated basis of his infections. And so he went through a pretty vigorous program of internal cleansings, sweat baths, massages, and also in a diet direction as well. And in about 4 or 5 days, he came to the place where his lungs were completely cleared. He felt better than he'd ever felt in his life before, so he said. And he went right back to work and has been working hard as a carpenter and builder ever since. And of course, he certainly has a good word to say for our little clinic down there in Australia. So that's just one experience that we can I can recall offhand in this direction. Now, as I said, Arthur Swift has come to join us there in Palmer's. He now is our type setter, which releases Margaret from this office, and he also takes care of all the massage patients that come along, especially the male patients. Margaret does the women and he does the men, and he's proved to be a tremendous blessing and help there in our institution there in Australia. I just recall now another experience I meant to mention to you, and it was this one. At the present time, there are quite a number of people coming to this group, the Bridgemead camp. And when, Peter Wilson joined this movement, he had a very, very strong desire to have Bob Bridgemead himself and Hope Taylor and the other members of the family take up this message. And he thought to himself, all I have to do is to show it to them and they'll accept it. Well, I said with a little smile, I said, well, look, Peter, I don't want to disappoint you, but I said, don't keep your hopes too high. Go and try. But I said, don't get so built up in your expectation that you are too disappointed. So I went down to see them, and of course, he got nowhere with them. Bob was quite courteous to him, but quite firm that this was not the truth. The second time I went back to see Hope Taylor, and he said to her, after a long conversation, he said to her, how are things going? And she said, not very well. He said, well, what's the matter? Well, she said, these days, everybody's going up the palm woods. Which to her, of course, would be very, very disappointing, to be sure. I'd like to switch now to one or two European experiences to just bring you up to date with what's going on over there. And in Europe this year, I seem to be perpetually running into ministers of religion in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Down in Switzerland, there has been a remarkable revival. There's a brother down there whose name is Brother John Klein. He speaks French and German, but hardly any English at all. And this man has set up his work professionally as a naturopath and chiropractor. And the course of his work down in St. Gallen, in the more or less eastern side of Switzerland, he began to interest some of the church members there in the message, until one family, the Herners by name, came out very, very strongly for the truth. When with typical European enthusiasm, they began to share the truth among other people there in this area, with the result that very soon there were half a dozen or more families who were agitated about this message. This really disturbed the minister, really, really did. And so when he heard that Wolfgang and myself were coming down to St. Gallen, he couldn't help hear this, of course, because the invitations were out. He then told the Herners at all costs, he wanted to see Wolfgang and myself before he began these meetings. Ostensibly to, perhaps, know what we taught and maybe even accept it. When I heard about it, I was quite sceptical, as I am with these preachers. I wasn't at all desirous of going to see him, but the plan was made and I more or less had to go along. We arrived up in his room, in his office, and he said to me, now I want to ask you one question. And I said, what is it? He said, I've heard you call the Seventh Adventist Church Babylon. Is this true? I don't want to believe it because other folks said, I want to hear it straight from the horse's mouth. Well, I said to him, that is not the question that we came here to answer. In fact, I said, it's not possible to answer that question unless, first of all, we have certain background. Because I knew what he wanted. He wanted me to say, why, certainly we call the church Babylon. And he'd say, thank you very much. And then he'd go to all his church members and say, see, anybody who calls the church Babylon is not of God. This man calls the church Babylon, he's not of God. As simple as that. So, remembering the experience of Nicodemus with Christ, I determined not to answer that question directly, but to, first of all, tell him in effect that he had to understand the message before he understand this question in regard to the church. Because the first angel is followed by the second angel, and you cannot switch them around. But he insisted. He wouldn't face the other question. He insisted, insisted, insisted. So I said, all right, to myself, you asked for it, so we'll give it to you. He had the book Movement of Destiny there, so I asked him to bring it out, and he did. He understood English reasonably well, enough to read the book, although not enough to talk it too well. And I showed him how in this book it wasn't a question of what I called the church, it was a question of what the church called herself. And I showed how Finn there literally identified the Seventh Adventist Church as being Babylon. Well, he kind of struggled with this, and he tried to argue to me that we of course quoted the text from 1 John 4:1-3, and he tried to argue to me that the Seventh Adventist Church believes that Christ was tempted in all points like as we are, therefore they had to be the Church of God. I said to him, look, the Bible does not say, it does not say that every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ was tempted in all things like as we are is of God. The Bible says that every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is of God, and every spirit that denies that is not of God. Now I said, that's the Bible test, and that's the one we stick to, not the one you're proposing. Well, of course, he had no way out of that. And in the end, he tried to say, well, that's an American book, and so forth. And I said, look, I said, what goes on in the General Conference of Seventh-day Adventists, I said, affects the entire world field. You as a preacher are supposed to be a watchman. Therefore, when these things happen, God expects you to stand up and in clear and unmistakable terms protest against this kind of thing. And so I see you doing this, I said, not that I can only believe that you endorse it. Well, he said, I'll have to study it, and excused us, and asked us the next time we came down to be sure and come back and see him again. Well, when we left his office, he got the telephone, began to telephone all his people and to tell them what dangerous men we were and on no account to come and hear us. The result of which was that one or two folks didn't come and hear us, of course, but one or two others came because they said, well, if that's what these kind of fellows are, I must go and hear them for myself and see if they are as bad as the preacher says. And so two or three folk did come and hear us on the Sabbath and the Sunday. We had a very intensive 2 days of meetings there in St. Gallen to present the message, which was extremely well received by the people there at that point of time. Now in Norway, and again in Münster, I had this problem with the preachers, and each time they kept claiming that that book by Frum was only Frum's opinion and did not reflect the thinking of the Seventh-day Adventist Church at all. Well, I had said to them, it was written by the Adventist most notable historian, was a report by him of what things were in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. It was published by the Review and Herald Publishing Association. It was endorsed by the General Conference President, and so on. But they still said, no, the paper is printed by the Review and Herald doesn't mean a thing. But I'll tell you something that you will remember in regard to this book, and you can verify this any time you'd like to go to Washington D.C. and go to the Review and Herald Publishing Association printing house. Before you start the tour, which I took this year when I was out there for Marilyn's sake, she was with me, they show you a slide presentation of the various aspects of the publishing work there in Washington D.C. They show you how that the copy comes in from various writers around the world, maybe it's a book or an article, as the case may be. And before that thing goes to the typesetting department, there's a committee which numbered, well, there's a long table, must be 10 or 15, 20 men all together. And there's a photograph of them. And the tape recorded commentary said that no book is ever published, no article ever goes to print until it's passed the screening of this committee. And this committee, the report said, are men who are so thoroughly versed in the doctrines of the church that they'll allow nothing to go through there unless it agrees with what the church believes at the present time. So therefore, those men, that committee of men, must have recognized the book Movement of Destiny as being a true representation of present Seventh-day Adventist thinking. That's worth knowing, isn't it? It means that book then is a true reflection of Adventist thinking, and I certainly believe it to be and know it to be. Because after all said and done, what is Froome doing? Froome is not expressing his opinion. Froome is reporting on certain developments inside the Seventh-day Adventist Church and describing the situation which now exists in the Seventh-day Adventist Church and giving very, very extensive documentary evidence to prove his point. And as I said before, it's published by the leading publishing house of the Adventist movements. It's distributed throughout the entire Adventist World Lord's Book and Bible houses. Is endorsed by the General Conference President, Elder Pearson, who said it's a must for every Seventh-day Adventist worker, and so on. And what is most significant of all, there's not one Seventh-day Adventist around the entire world that is protesting against that book, and silence is consent. Isn't that right? Silence is consent. So that in every single case, I've used these arguments against these ministers and as a most useful weapon, because then instead of my calling the church Babylon to them, for them to use this, I simply tell them that the church calls herself Babylon. And if the church does that and they don't protest against this thing, then they are calling their own church Babylon too. I've left all these ministers very, very much discomforted. In Munster, for instance, this was most interesting. We had gone to the camp meeting in Germany, and there were two people at the camp meeting in Germany, three people. There was a man and his wife, Brother Rurig is his name, Sister Rurig, and another sister who is a Dutch sister, Sister Luckman. I think she's a widow at the present moment, and she's come to live in Germany in Münster. And these folk had all three been in the Brinsmead camp until this recent somersault by Brinsmead. They left the Brinsmead camp, and they had all come to the camp meeting there in Germany and come away absolutely thrilled with what they'd heard and determined to really share their light in Münster. Much to the dismay of the minister and the church elder there. Now, the church elder's name is Fieldweber, I think, something like that. And about 8 years ago, when I was in Münster for the first time, this man actually let me preach in the church. One of my rare, rare such experiences. And when the service was over, he told me, "Brother," he said, "I agree with every word you said, every word." So on this Sunday, when we were there in Münster together, Wolfgang and I, about 15 people came along to crowd to a tiny room, no more than 10 feet wide and about 12 feet long. They were really packed in. And there was the preacher, and there was the church elder. For 2 hours, Wolfgang gave a study in straight German to these folks, and I followed up with another half an hour, or another 45 minutes, of a translator study. And in those 3 hours, we covered the message pretty well. When we were done, the preacher and the elder said to both of us, "We agree with every word you've said." And the preacher said, "And what is more, I preached exactly that for 25 years in the church." Well, we knew better, of course. We knew better. And their trickery, of course, was to show or try and show there was no point at all now being separate from the church. Because they all knew that. And they wanted to impress the hearers there with the thought that why? Here we preach the same thing, they preached it, we preached it, so if we're outside the church, there must be something wrong. Why don't we all come back and join together in the church and preach this message together? And then they said, began to read all these statements about the church not being Babylon, and they began to press us with the question about where we call the church Babylon too. So once again, we answered in the usual way, which delighted our hearers. They thought that was a very wonderful way to answer. And they seem to enjoy seeing the minister being discomforted by the fact that we put it this way. But they kept insisting, these preachers kept insisting that up in Hannover, which was just, I don't know how far, but 150 kilometres up the line, I suppose, in an east northeasterly direction, where we have the strongest single group in Europe. You may remember my telling you about Sister Crystal Schumann, the secretary of the union there, who'd come out 3 or 4 years ago. Well, she's still with us, as strong as ever, very strong and very happy in the message. And the minister their minister had actually stayed with that particular woman and had baptized her into the Adventist faith, and they were most disturbed to think that she'd left that and come into this message. We smiled, of course. We really were sorry that we didn't think about this till later, till after they'd gone. But we remembered that that Crystal Schumann had declared that she'd never ever heard this thing taught in the church, and yet the minister, her very minister, claimed to have taught it for 25 years. So there was a little discrepancy somewhere. Well, they tried to claim it up in Hanover that these folk had left the church because of their influence and for no other reason but that. And fortunately, Wolfgang had in his satchel there a little booklet published by the Hanover Church in which they had attacked us directly in respect to the message and declared the message to be totally and completely false. And he pulled this down and showed it to the preachers, and that left them without any answers anymore at all. And I think they were quite glad and happy to leave. And we told them in very...